Hello, Gallatin Valley. You're listening to Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman 95.9 FM. I'm your host, Dr. Nurse Nancy. Today's topic is two bills introduced into the Montana House of Representatives that were strongly opposed by LGBTQ groups and civil rights groups for reasons we'll discuss. We're recording on January 26th, and today one of those bills, HB 113, was killed on the House floor, but there's no guarantee that similar legislation won't be introduced in the future. The other bill, HB 12, is still alive at this time. Our guest today is Kendra Nevin, who has frequently testified at the state and local levels to promote human rights for LGBTQ people, and who testified against HB 112 and 113 last week. We'll be talking about what it's like for her as a trans woman and for members of the trans community to have legislators try to pass bills that limit options for trans people. Our special guest is Dr. Lauren Wilson, who also testified against both bills. Dr. Wilson grew up in Missoula and serves as a pediatric hospitalist. She is vice president of the Montana chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Wilson is on call tonight, but will join us for as long as she can. Dr. Wilson, could you please start by telling us what House Bill 113 would have done and why you opposed it?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on the show as well. I appreciate that. So House Bill 113 is a bill that essentially penalizes medical providers for providing what we would consider to be the standard of care for transgender people, which is gender-affirming care in all its forms. And that bill initially started with a financial penalty for medical providers of between $500 and $50,000. And it was actually amended to be a different penalty, which would threaten our licensure if we were to do this care.
Mm. So what is the standard of care for minors who come to pediatricians? Sure.
Yeah, there are a lot of medical societies that kind of get together and review the available evidence that's out there, and they re-review it at some interval and decide what the best possible care is and then publish that. And my society that I go by, because I'm a pediatrician, is the American Academy of Pediatrics. And they've put out a guideline, I think now it's 2 years old, that talks about gender-affirming care in kids. It also refers to other guidelines from other different types of medical specialties, because there are different aspects of that care that, say, an obstetrician or a surgeon or a psychologist would need to know. So I can speak to that if that's helpful.
Well, yeah, I'd love to know, especially for trans kids, what is the standard of care? We're going to be talking later in the show, and I think that you heard during testimony from Adam Edelman about what happened to his child, Sam, when Sam was not able to get puberty-blocking hormones. And I'm just wondering, these days, what is the standard of care when a young person at the beginning of puberty or before puberty or in puberty comes to you and says, I think I'm trans?
Sure. Yeah. So that's a great question. And to kind of start at the beginning, we know that children form their identities fairly early. So sometime, you know, when they're 3 or 4, most children have some idea of what their gender is. And there are children who at that age, a lot of my transgender patients, you know, already when they're 3 or 4 say, you know, I might have been born a boy, but I'm a girl. That's just who I am. And some kids, you play around with different gender behaviors, and they're not truly transgender. So a lot of what we tell parents is, you know, if your child is telling you that they're a different gender, then it's best to meet them where they're at and to support that and just affirm that your child is someone that you love, someone that you support, and in any way, shape, or form that they choose to express themselves, then you can provide that support. And so medical therapy for young kids, for kids before puberty who are transgender, really just deals with letting them express themselves. So if they want a different haircut, if they want to wear different clothes, if they want to call themselves by a name that feels more natural to them and use different pronouns, then those are things that we say you should support. And some children go on to socially transition. So they might go to school as their female gender rather than the male gender that they were born with. And socially transitioning, we know, does decrease some of the distress that young kids can feel when they when their identity doesn't match their sex that was assigned at birth. So that's something that can be extremely helpful.
I was going to say, I think that we will talk more about the importance of social transitioning, especially maybe when we talk about House Bill 112. But yeah. Kendall, were you raising your hand over there? We're all socially distancing here.
Yeah, I was. I just had a question for Dr. Wilson regarding...
Absolutely.
It came out in testimony about the desistance of trans youth. And I was just wondering if you could speak to what the actual desistance number is rather than what they were putting out at the hearing.
And maybe define desistance.
Sure. And it must be said that I am not a pediatric endocrinologist, so I know our guidelines and I am not familiar in depth with every single study. And a lot of things that were brought up during the hearing, I had trouble knowing where those were even sourced from. There's a lot of literature out there that's a little bit misleading as well, that's being used for political purposes. So what I can say is, you know, when young kids are expressing themselves differently, you know, not all of them will go on to be persistent and consistent and live in their gender, their authentic gender. There are some kids who, you know, will desist, for lack of a better term. That word has been misused, so I'm a little bit uncomfortable with it. But once you have a child who's, you know, starting puberty and who's been really consistent and persistent in their gender, and they're someone who we evaluate to see if they might need blocker therapy, which we can talk about later, then those children really have very, very low rates of changing back, transitioning back, as was said in testimony. So once they start with blockers, once they've been evaluated and say, you know, this is really something that feels natural and has felt authentic for some time, then most who go on to complete medical therapy and gender affirming care don't regret doing so. They have some studies that look at regrets. And there's a 40-year cohort that they looked at in the Netherlands, and less than 1% of people expressed regret about doing a gender transition, as they called it in that article. And some of the things that they regretted was not actually transitioning, but the choice of this procedure that might have had a side effect or something like that, and maybe they would have chosen something slightly differently if they did it again.
So could you talk about what happens physiologically during puberty if you don't use, if you progress through puberty without using blocking hormones, and then also what happens during puberty if you do for a time use gender blocking hormones?
The question about what happens with blockers is one that I think preoccupied a lot of people with this testimony because it's just unfamiliar. But essentially what blockers are there medications that suppress the body's ability to produce hormones. And they're medications that we've had for 40 years. We use them for precocious puberty, so puberty that starts too early, because that can be socially difficult for kids. And, you know, occasionally if it's way too early, we need to suppress it. It's also used in older men with prostate issues. So blockers are medications that have really good safety profiles and have been used in different scenarios. But in this particular case, for someone who's transgender, when we start to see signs that puberty is arriving, that's the time to really think about whether blocker therapy is something that would be a benefit. And not all families, not all children, not all families want blockers or would benefit from blockers, but a lot do, because the changes of puberty and the gender that you don't feel is authentic to you are really distressing. And that's when we see a lot of teenagers start to struggle with depression, anxiety, and suicidal thoughts sometimes. So blocker therapy can be initiated shortly after puberty starts. And what it does is really just suppresses puberty from continuing. So if you were to start blockers, someone who is born female, they would not develop breast tissue. They would not develop kind of that female appearing body. And blockers are fully reversible. So what they essentially do is they hit the pause button on puberty so that kids have more time to live in their authentic gender, time to get older, time to mature. And they can make further decisions kind of later on in teenagerhood.
Okay, thank you. You're listening to Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman. Our guests today are Dr. Lauren Wilson and Kendra Nevin. We are talking about two bills that were introduced into the Montana House of Representatives that would have limited the options for transgender folks. One of them was killed on the floor today. We are talking about it. That's HB 113. The other one is still alive. I have heard recordings of the testimony, and I would like us to listen for a moment to the testimony offered by Adam Edelman about his child and the death of his child and how not being able to receive appropriate care played into that.
You know, our son, Sam, it's almost 5 years now since he passed away. He took his own life while a student at University of Montana. He was our firstborn, and he was transgender, and he knew he was transgender for as long as he could remember. The challenges associated with what he was going through, including in high school, having a pediatrician or a doctor refuse hormone treatment, led to significant despair. And there's the lack of societal support, even with some of the changes that we've seen in a positive way in the last 5 years, that basically took one of the kindest, most compassionate, smartest, most capable individuals you'd ever meet and tore him up to the point where he gave up and he took his own life. So that's seeing a bill like this stirs just a tremendous amount of, frankly, agony in my family. And we hope that you consider what's truly at stake with what this is doing, even just having it being proposed, let alone moving it through the House and moving it into law, will do to so many of our people, so many people in our community, our brothers and sisters, our children, our neighbors, our friends.
Kendra, I know that you knew Sam Edelman. I'd like to invite you to share anything you would like about Sam. But also I'd like to ask you to share a little of your own experience in two ways. One is that as an adolescent, you did not have any access to puberty blockers. I'd like to talk about how that has impacted your life and the lives of other people you know. And then more broadly, I'd like to sort of get to what Adam was talking about the emotional agony that seeing these kinds of bills proposed causes, but starting with Sam.
Okay. Our community in Montana is pretty small. It's a small state, population-wise. It's a large state land-wise, but we stay in contact with each other, a lot of us, and we lean on each other when times are hard. And Sam happens to have been from where I live, and so, you know, I know him from those social circles. And he was an incredible person. I had a little bit of insight into some of the things that had been bothering him. And, you know, I also commiserated because I totally understood where he was coming from. My own experience is that, you know, when I was around Sam's age, I was feeling exactly like he was. And for the same reasons, because I had just come through puberty at that age, and it was more than disheartening. As I went through the changes, which felt wrong the whole time, and I know that for everyone, puberty is awkward, but for me, it was soul-crushing, because it was when I realized that there was no turning back. There was nothing that could be done. My body was going to betray me, and I was going to have to live with what I was becoming for the rest of my life. And I remember one time I used to, you know, when I was a teenager, I used to wear my mom's shoes. We had the same shoe size. And one of the things that really devastated me was when I outgrew her shoes.
Oh.
And I'm not saying, you know, I went into my mom's closet and I wore her heels and I pranced around. That isn't what I mean. I wore her boat shoes that were always sitting by the door because we had the same size. And, you know, it just made me feel good. I shared that with my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I outgrew it, you know, it drove the point home that, you know, I'm going beyond my mother. I outgrew her in height. And I was going to look masculine the rest of my life. And that was really hard to take. I remember one time, it was a Thanksgiving. No, it was an Easter. The family got together and they were getting ready for church. And my mom pulled me aside and she said, you know, you should just, you need to go in the bathroom and you need to shave those hairs off your chin. And... those hairs on my chin were being ignored for a reason. And when I finally, you know, when other people were seeing them and when I finally had to address them, I went into that bathroom at my grandma's house and I couldn't come out for a half an hour because I couldn't stop crying.
Hmm.
And because, again, it was one of those, you know, milestones that I passed that I never wanted to. So I knew a lot about what Sam was feeling and the fact that he was, you know, denied that care, or at least didn't have access to it, just like me. So,
yeah. And when you were an adolescent, I don't know how widely. I mean, it sounds as if those medications have been around for a long time for other purposes. Maybe it wasn't the standard of care now then. Whatever the standard of care was, but that it's available now, and that Sam had a doctor whose job was to care for him.
Right.
And didn't.
Yeah, and this is, you know, currently what is known to work. So, you know, it was available to him, unlike it was to me. I'd never even heard of such a thing when I was that age. I just thought there was nothing, you know?
Yeah.
And I guess at the time, as far as the medical community was concerned, there was nothing. You know, it was just something I was going to have to bear. I forgot the last part of your question.
Well, actually, I was going to say, you know, as you're talking, I do want to get to a broader question of how these bills impact psychologically, spiritually, emotionally, and mental health for people in the trans community, just the fact that they exist, even if they don't pass. But I think what I'd like to do is play, I remember a mother who testified against this bill very movingly about how important appropriate care was for her family. Let's listen to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jamie, J-A-I-M-E, Gabrielli, G-A-B-R-I-E-L-L-I. I am a proud mother of two incredible kids, a daughter who is 18 and a 16-year-old son. When I was pregnant and people asked if I hoped for a boy or a girl, I said I don't care as long as they're healthy. That statement has proved truer than I could have ever imagined at the time. My son is transgender. I knew something was different regarding gender with him very early on, but I didn't know what that meant. And as he got older, I knew this was something more than I could explain by saying, he's a tomboy or a girl who likes boy things. And I have made many mistakes in my less than graceful journey as the parent of a trans child. The intentions of all my decisions for both of my kids have always been to protect and preserve their health and well-being. But it took me a long time to learn and understand what to do to help my son. And when I knew better, I did better. I researched, talked to medical and mental health experts, and I listened to my son and other trans people. I finally came to understand two things as facts. Being transgender is not a choice, and being transgender is not negotiable. knowing the real life debilitating suffering gender dysphoria caused my son, and after years of working toward beginning this process, I can tell you immorality is not part of being trans or part of parents trying to find best practice medical care for their children who are in need. These are necessary interventions, and these are doctors who have taken an oath to do no harm. For transgender people like my child, the necessary effort to feel at home in their body is a planned, informed, thoughtful process. And this does not happen quickly. And yes, it does take a lifetime to see through. More importantly, this is a choice that often comes as one of two remaining options: end life or transition. When dying by suicide is a statistically high outcome for your child, you don't wait to do something to help them. You do everything you can to keep your child alive. And I wish I had found my son this help sooner, but I'm immensely thankful I did not wait any longer. We have built trusting relationships with doctors who specialize in helping kids like him. And having access to these professionals has changed my son's life in all the ways I hoped, and in many ways I did not even anticipate. I see him beginning to thrive because he is finally able to be who he is.
And as he gets farther into his transition,
I realize he's the same kid he's always been. HB 113 would force courageous kids like my son who are living in pain and dysphoria to wait and suffer longer because they can't get the help they need. Making necessary medical care that trans kids rely on illegal does not protect them. Rather than protect them, these misguided intentions would cause many kids, including my child, irrevocable harm. My plea to you is to please protect my child's health and well-being. Help him continue to thrive and help him continue to be who he is and have the right, just as we all do, to do that. Thank you.
Can you talk to us, Dr. Wilson, about how hard or how easy it is to access appropriate care here in Montana?
Sure. Yeah, we live in a really rural state, so that is a good question. A lot of care for transgender kids is done by pediatric endocrinologists, especially for young kids. And they have other doctors and other specialists who can help them out. Some of the family doctors have large panels of people who are getting gender-affirming care, and they kind of specialize in that. But in Montana, that's few and far between. If you're looking for gender-affirming care for a child, there's only a couple cities where that's really available. And so it's hard. Families who are getting this care have really worked to get there. They've really been persistent in wanting to do what is best for their child and what their child needs. And I think that's a consideration. This isn't something you can walk in off the street and ask for anywhere. It's not like that at all.
No, I hadn't thought about that, that not only does the parent have to come to the point where they recognize that this is the way to go, but then they have to fight really hard for it. Kendra, did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, the proponents often make it seem like, you know, if some little girl out on the playground picks up a truck, then automatically she's just shuffled into a doctor and forced to be a boy. And I was just wondering if you could explain a little bit about the psychological vetting process that goes into this, you know, to trans youth care as well.
Yeah, so there's a multidisciplinary team involved in this care. It's not just, you know, one person in an office somewhere. And that should involve a psychotherapist or psychologist with expertise in care for transgender people. Particularly for kids, and particularly when they're making decisions later on in adolescence, usually age 16 or up, about hormone therapy and about things that are only partially reversible, that's when we really make sure that there's been continuity of care with a relationship with a therapist, that there's been other evaluations. A lot of the guidelines suggest that you have at least two people do evaluation and make sure that they feel like this is the right path. So a lot of my transgender patients joke that they've been evaluated more than just about anyone else by the time they get to that point.
This is Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman. Our guests today are Dr. Lauren Wilson and Kendra Nevin. We are talking about bills that have been introduced into the Montana House of Representatives that limit options for trans people. We've heard two clips now from parents of trans people. Kendra, in the 2-3 minutes we have remaining, could you just talk a little bit sort of more broadly about how the fact that these bills even were proposed affects people in the trans community in terms of their mental health?
Yeah, I actually have pretty intimate knowledge of this. Back when House Bill 2 was being promoted over in North Carolina, it was in the national news. And, you know, being involved with my own community in this state and helping lead meetings, you know, of support and things like this, I had a lot of, you know, feedback on where everyone's mind was, and it was devastating. And it just so happens that it was around that time, you know, when we did lose Sam, and we also lost two others in that same period of time when that bill became law in North Carolina, just from that national news. So I can't say that that was the direct effect of it, but I can say that, you know, the collective feelings of trans people in Montana were definitely impacted from what I heard. So, you know.
Please join us in the next half hour as we continue talking about the effect of anti-trans legislation that some legislators have tried to pass in Montana.
We share an earth that is dying. We live in a society in which racism is endemic. Antisemitism, sexism, heterosexism, classism, ageism, they are endemic. Being women will not save us from these distortions around our difference. It is not enough to say we are against racism. It is not enough to say we believe. If we do not testify with our living, then we turn who we are over to our enemies.
That was Audrey Lorde, recorded in 1989. The MSU Library and the Office of Diversity and Inclusion will host a book display honoring Audre Lorde and three other women writers in celebration of Black History Month. This display will include works by Tracy K. Smith, Mahogany L. Brown, and Roxane Gay, among others. Please join us in celebrating these authors in the month of February at the MSU Library.